You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm your host, as always, Ankit Panda. And today we have a special guest joining us from the Philippines to discuss Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. As our listeners are well aware, the South China Sea is a hot topic in the news these days, particularly as we anticipate the Permanent Court of Arbitration's decision in Philippines versus China very soon, possibly later this summer. Joining me today is Anders Kaur, and I'll ask Anders to introduce himself real quick. Anders, thanks for joining me. Do you want to tell our audience a bit about yourself and who you are?
Well, I am a I have a consulting business called Kaur Analytics, and I'm also a scholar. I'm doing some work on South China Sea scholarship. We have a six-volume series coming out on the South China Sea with 53 authors around the world.
Thank you. Well, thanks a lot for joining me, Anders. And I should note that I'm actually lucky enough to be one of the authors included in that volume. So it's good to have you on
Thank
the show
you.
Finally. Anders,
yeah,
so the reason you're on the show today is because, as I take it, you were recently on the water with an activist group in the Philippines known as Kalayaan Atin Ito. The Kalayaan Atin Ito movement, for our listeners, and I'm sure Anders will explain in more detail, is essentially trying to spread awareness of China's militarization of the South China Sea, particularly near Pagasa Island and Scarborough Shoal in the Spratlys. So, Anders, can you tell us a bit about this, this fact-finding mission, I guess, that you were on in the South China Sea, and what exactly you saw?
Yeah, I'll go back in history just a little bit. In 2012, after the Scarborough Shoal standoff between the Chinese and Philippine Coast Guards, there was an agreement, and the Philippines Coast Guard backed off, expecting the Chinese to do the same. And they didn't. They stayed at Scarborough. Negotiations ensued, and an individual named Nicanor Felden decided he was going to go out to Scarborough in a protest boat, and he was called right before he launched, after he had assembled activists to go out there as a protest, and by the president of the Philippines, Aquino, and asked not to go out there. So he stood down at that time, and then 3 years later, when still the Scarborough Shoal was occupied by the Chinese, Nick got, decided to have a second, what he called freedom voyage or patriotic voyage, and he went to Pagasa Island with about 40 students from around Philippines. He did a sort of informational lectures at the universities, brought a lot of activists on, built the movement, and now he's actually gone into government now with the new Duterte government here. He's becoming the minister of customs, and another woman has taken over the group. Her name's Joy, and she led a couple days ago this trip out to Scarborough, where we actually encountered some pretty aggressive moves by the Chinese Coast Guard. There were two cutters there, which are pretty big ships with a lot of guns on them, and there was a medium large boat, Chinese Coast Guard boat, plus two speedboats. And they blocked our path to Scarborough Shoal. They looked like they were going to ram us by coming straight at us at a fairly decent amount of speed and then veering off at the last minute. It sent our volunteers and activists scattering to put on their life vests when they saw the ship getting too close. And then they asked us to leave. They yelled at us to leave. They waved their hands, telling us to leave. But we weren't going anywhere because we were there to show that we had a right to be there. It's within the Philippines 200-mile EEZ, or Exclusive Economic Zone. So we have a right to, or the Philippines has a right to fish there and explore there for oil, et cetera. So we just stayed there after talking to them for a while and making clear that we weren't leaving and noting that they didn't really do anything about it other than wave their arms a bit. we decided to start fishing. So we started fishing. And after we fished for a while, we decided, why don't we go for a swim? So a couple of us jumped in to take a swim. And I actually got back out at that point. And then four others jumped in. So there were five total in the water. And they swam to, they tried to basically get a flag onto the shoal.
A Philippines flag.
A Philippines flag. They also had a UN flag to highlight the UNCLOS rules and how those protect the Philippine CEZ.
Oh, very interesting.
Convention on the Law of the Sea. So that might have been one of the first raisings of a UN flag on such a kind of a protest flag planting. But what ended up happening was the first woman to go in, Joy, who leads the group, got jumped on by both speedboats that really dangerously close to her were revving their propellers to shoot water in her face and basically to intimidate her. So the propellers were coming within 3 feet of her. She had to grab onto the boat, sometimes push the boat away from her as the rear of the boat was swung around by the Chinese Coast Guard in a very threatening way.
Wow.
So it was certainly life-threatening for her and for the other swimmer that was with her, which was one of the fishermen that was crewing our boat and just jumped in with his homemade wooden fins or flippers to be next to her while she was doing this. They tried to grab the bag that she had the flags in with a gaffer's hook. The bag, the dry bag was punctured. The flag was punctured. The UN flag was punctured. So she was out there for about an hour, actually, total. All the swimmers were out there for about an hour. Meanwhile, a couple of other swimmers jumped off the boat and headed in by a slightly different route. So while the Chinese fishermen were focused on Joy, the other swimmers actually made it past the boats. You know, she acted as sort of a diversion for them to make it past the boats. And one of the swimmers raised a small Philippine flag and waved it around a bit to show that they were still there. They still have sovereignty over this. Or they still have it as an EEZ, at least.
Right.
Maybe they have sovereignty. So finally, after about an hour of, you know, the folks on the boat, me and on the big boat, me and the skipper decided we really should try to get Joy back into the boat before she got too tired and maybe got hurt. So we moved the boat, the bigger boat, the fishing boat, it's about a 90-foot fishing boat, up to where the two small speedboats were. And we yelled and motioned to Joy to get back in the boat, which she did. So it was a success because we did get the flag onto the shoal with two swimmers made it onto the shoal and stood up with the flag. And so that was a huge success. We fished underneath the noses of the Chinese Coast Guard despite their threats.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned around and claimed the victory that day. The young volunteers, and some of them are very young, sang a national anthem. It's been shared, if you look on Facebook, I think over 100,000 times, or it's been viewed 100,000 times. So it's got a tremendous amount of attention in the Philippines, which is part of the point, is public education of, hey, there's a shoal out there that matters a lot, and, you know, currently it's under Chinese occupation. So
right.
I think we really did something to stir an interest in the public,
well,
further interest in the public.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Anders, for that gripping first-person account. It's often very rare that we'll get something like this coming out of Scarborough Shoal. Oftentimes, we rely on satellite imagery more than anything to get an idea of Chinese behavior in the area. Some of the listeners to this podcast may have read coverage in The Diplomat of potential Chinese reclamation happening at Scarborough Shoal. U.S. officials were concerned about that recently. Anders, I do want to ask you... you know, we've read several reports of both the Chinese Coast Guard and Chinese fishermen engaging in highly provocative behavior, not only in the Philippines EEZ, but more recently also in the Indonesian EEZ, in the Malaysian EEZ, obviously with Vietnam, it goes without saying, with the 2014 oil rig standoff. You know, a lot of what you were describing, it sounded like the potential for something to go wrong and for there to actually be, you know, a loss of life or a serious incident involving, you know, your boat potentially having been rammed. You know, what is the potential for escalation here or a miscalculation?
Well, I think there's definitely potential that these, you know, this particular, you know, pilot of the speedboat was very, very dangerous with the swimmers. I mean, if you can imagine, she's in the water for over an hour, and this boat was just, these two speedboats were doing donuts around her, up as close as 3 feet. The propellers got as close as 3 feet. So that could easily, if she had moved her arm the wrong way, or if they had lost control of the boat for a split second, she could have lost a limb or she could have been killed. So, and she knew it, and I'm sure they knew it, and it was, I think it was a very purposeful and very threatening move on their part, and it's gotten tremendous amounts of press in the Philippines, and the assistant foreign minister in the Philippines felt compelled to answer questions on air about it. And so I think it's making China look pretty bad right now.
And how does the government of the Philippines view these activities? If you could just talk a bit about that, as in the activities of the activists.
What the assistant foreign secretary said was that, first of all, he couldn't confirm, and this is the translation that I got from the activist, because he was speaking Tagalog, but he couldn't confirm that there are actually Chinese boats at Scarborough Shoal. Secondly, it was dangerous, and we shouldn't do that. It was a needless risk of life. Thirdly, we should have coordinated with them. And the answer of the activist is that, well, they tried to coordinate. I mean, they've tried to coordinate in the past, and what the government typically does is try to stop them from going. And actually, one of the people that were sent to film from Vietnam, who's doing a movie about the South China Sea, a documentary, was told that he couldn't, you know, participate in the action. He could just film it, but he couldn't go on the boat. So,
you know, is there any concern on the part of the Philippines government that activities like this could potentially jeopardize the Philippines' position in the ongoing case or have any sort of effect on the verdict there?
Well, I don't think so. I think that an active population demanding its rights, if anything, should influence the verdict in its favor. So I think it strengthens the Philippines' bargaining position. I think it strengthens the case, even though that would be a non-legal influence. But I do think that it would have a positive effect on the Philippines' case. Mm-hmm. And once it's decided, it will be a basis, you know, a social movement basis for insisting on getting the claim. Now, China might be able to influence the Philippine government to back off of its claim if there's no social movement that is holding leadership to account. But if there's a social movement out there that's holding leadership to account, then I don't think you're going to see a very easy way for the Philippine government to walk away from its claim on Scarborough.
Right. Anders, if you don't mind, I want to also talk a bit about the broader, Philippines' position in the South China Sea, not just involving Scarborough Shoal, but the broader approach to these disputes, the pending case at the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Particularly, you're in the Philippines at a very interesting time. Rodrigo Duterte is set to be inaugurated as the next president at the end of this month. Could you tell me a bit about what your read is from the Philippines about this transition from the Aquino government to the Duterte government and how that might affect how the Philippines navigates both its relationship with China and its claims in the South China Sea?
Well, I think Duterte has really played a skillful game with China, and he's gone back and forth a bit about the claims that Philippines has on the South China Sea, about whether he's willing to do bilateral or multilateral negotiations, with bilateral being far superior for China and far preferable to China. So now he's gone back to multilateral negotiations. He's said that he would never give up rights to the West Philippine Sea. And very interestingly, he appointed Nick Felden, who's founded this activist group, as customs commissioner, which is the second biggest revenue-producing organ of the Philippine government. It's a very, very important post, and so I think that shows that he's going to be pretty tough on maintaining a claim to the South China Sea. So
right. I also wanted to, I've read reports that Duterte is more interested than his predecessor in encouraging federalism within the Philippines, encouraging local governments to be more empowered in their own affairs. How would that play out with, communities in Palawan and these, Calayan communities who do have a direct stake in the ability to fish freely in the South China Sea EEZ, for example? Do you see that having an important role in how the Philippines views its claims there?
I think so. I think, what would you think about that? Turn the tables on you and ask you the question.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting idea. I'm not sure how I see it playing out in reality. Certainly, Duterte himself, as the mayor of Davao City, saw some of the benefits of having a highly autonomous leadership style, if I can put it that way. Look, the Philippines is a highly archipelagic state. There are questions of national unity. Federalism also has a whole host of budgetary issues associated with it, the way I understand it. Again, I'm not an expert on this, so I can't speak in great detail. But at least it seems to me like these communities, particularly based in Palawan and the Calayan communities as well, might stand to benefit. But honestly, given the Philippines' already limited military capabilities, they might be better off sticking together. And that's interesting. I think with the initialization of EDCA with the United States and of oncoming assistance both from Japan and under the U.S. Maritime Security Initiative, depending on how the Philippines can develop its own defense capabilities and allocate those to local governments and local authorities, I think that's going to play a big part in determining how this will all play out.
Right. Yeah, I think I basically agree with that. It'll be an interesting to see. It's a wait and see with the new president-elect, see what happens. But as far as I know, from what I've seen, at least from the South China Sea perspective, I think he may be on the right track.
All right. Well, Anders, thanks a lot for joining me on the podcast today and for sharing your first-person account of what you saw at Scarborough Shoal.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we hope to have you back on the show soon. So that was Anders Kaur of Kaur Analytics discussing his firsthand experience of Chinese assertive behavior in the South China Sea, specifically near Scarborough Shoal. For listeners, make sure you do subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and please do leave us a review and your comments on how we can improve the show. I'm also trying to solicit more listener feedback on possible future topics for the show. So if you have any ideas for what you'd like to see, and keep in mind that we cover basically everything in the Asia Pacific, and that region is defined very broadly from essentially everything east of Iran and west of the international dateline. So if you're interested in anything particular that we haven't covered yet on the podcast, or you see an interesting piece on The Diplomat and you'd like us to speak to the author on this show, definitely let me know, either by sending me an email at ankit@thediplomat.com, or you can also find me on Twitter at nktpnd. Thanks again for listening.